This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore. Why don't you talk to me?
Good evening, my name is Sue and you're listening to Hear Me Roar, Joy's all-female current affairs program. Co-hosting with me tonight are the lovely Kathy and Tessa.
Good evening, Sue.
Good evening. Kathy and I have decided that we actually do wear the same clothes most weeks.
We've got some sort of lesbian uniform going on.
We have.
The black tee and the jeans and the black and white Connies.
The Connies.
You're a couple or something.
We are.
Now couples start dressing like one another after a while.
That's
it's actually...
It.
Yeah. It's really bad. You end up fighting over who can wear the grey jacket that day.
Too true. Yeah. You know, after the show, maybe we should pop down to Kathmandu and get some matching fleeces.
Could we?
A little less.
I'd like that.
Yes,
That'd be terrific. I wouldn't. Later on this hour, we're going to be talking to Georgie. She originally she was going to bring her partner in, but she's not feeling well. So I hope, Rachel, you are feeling a little bit better. And they're discussing, or Georgie's discussing, their journey in making a family. So they're much like any other lesbians. They're living their lives in their inner suburban home. They love to cook and share evenings, do all those really nice, cool things, but there's something missing. Yes. That whiny noise.
A whiny Kathy?
Yes. Yeah, a cat. No.
But we could give you Kathy anyway.
A little baby.
So they've embarked on a journey, in search of sperm and parenthood. So it'd be really interesting talking to Georgie about that, all the political and the legal issues as well.
Starting a family.
Well,
I'm not quite there yet.
Isn't it? It's becoming one of these things, like, you know, when I sort of left heterosexualdom and my straight friends behind and thought, you know, this is probably not the path I'm ever going to be taking, because I can't just go and get myself knocked up. It's not that easy. But a surprising amount of my lesbian couple friends are moving towards creating their own families, and we're all getting to our mid to late 30s, so it's a very interesting shift.
Yeah.
In thinking that it's quite okay, it's normal. It's
See, I'm pre-shift. I'm going, woohoo, I can shag as much as I want, and there is literally no way that I can impregnate somebody. How wonderful. But I'm sure that there is that point in one's life where becomes bane of your existence rather than...
Yeah,
it is. I think it does.
It'd be interesting to talk to them about the loopholes, as you said, but also the personal journey that they have to go through, so finding someone who wants to do it and then figuring out the mechanics of it, because there's the whole thing between whether you actually have an anonymous donor or someone who's involved, and what parenting, how much visitation do they have, what sort of monetary input do they have, etc.
And that's what makes it so much more complicated for gay and lesbian couples.
Mm.
It's not just, you know...
Well, it's all premeditated, isn't
it? Yeah, it's also had to be so well thought out and so forth. So, Kathy, what's going on?
Rightio, well, we've got a survey that's happened in the US from the Human Rights Campaign Foundation, which has found that 51% of lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender workers continue to hide their identity from their colleagues. The report, which is called Degrees of Equality, a National Study Examining Workplace Climate for LGBT Employees, try saying that 10 times, found that despite significant advances in employment policies at most US corporations, a majority of queer workers continue to experience a range of negative consequences because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. And it's interesting that even younger workers are even more likely to stay in the closet, with only 5% of those aged 18 to 24 saying they're not totally open, compared to 20% in older groups.
So that's a bit of a twofold thing, because you think, oh, young people, you know, new generation, easy, it's fun to be gay and all that sort of thing. But then there's the other side, like they're not fully 100% maybe okay with themselves yet. And so maybe that's why they kind of stay in the closet at work.
Or maybe it's because they actually don't give a shit. Maybe they don't think that it's necessary so much as we did, saying, okay, I'm gay, haha, take me on. Mm. Whereas, I don't give a shit. I'm gay, I'm going to keep it to myself. What my sexuality is, it's none of your business.
Well, I think it would depend upon the kind of industry you're in. If you're in a male-dominated industry like engineering or, you know, probably not airlines, let's say, but let's say something, or law or the police force, if you're a woman, if you're a lesbian, coming out is probably something that's not as easy as if you were, say, a teacher or, you know, a journalist or some, you know, in some in the education department.
I just find it must be quite difficult to just come out anyway. Like, I found it was safety in numbers because there are a few of us. I worked with a friend that I knew was gay, and then suddenly there was this bit of a gay club, and it was actually quite cool to be gay, and it was like, oh, you're not gay working here?
Don't know
if we're going to talk to you. So it was a bit of a safety in numbers thing, you know, like there were a group of us, we're all, you know, everyone knew that we were gay, and it was completely comfortable. If you're just one person, maybe at a new job, it's kind of almost an awkward thing, like, what, do you pop it out at morning tea? I'm gay.
Yes, you do.
Well, it's those social conversations you have. What did you do on the weekend? Mm. Do you have a boyfriend? You know, those kinds of things that lead to that. Well, no, I went to, you know, I'm actually a bear, and I went to a leather club, and, you know, or you know, went to a sauna or whatever. Do you know
but
what
you
mean?
Rely on
or
those
which would
opening
explain
questions.
The clothing
and the hairy chest.
Right.
And
I can't get past that one. Sorry.
Moving past the bears. Another one looking at young gay bisexual teens and bisexual teens. A study by Harvard University and Children's Hospital Boston found that gay bisexual and sort of bisexual teens are actually more likely to have an eating disorder than their heterosexual counterparts, which I found quite interesting because you think, you know, young lesbians, they don't give a stuff, they're like, I don't care what I look like, but they found that they're twice as likely to binge eat and actually become bulimic than straight women are.
Yes, but there's a catch, isn't there? Tell us the punchline to
I'm going to have to read this verbatim, it's a bit of a laugh. Among females, lesbian, bisexual and mostly heterosexual respondents, there were about twice as likely as their heterosexual counterparts to report binge eating at least once per month in the last year. But get this, bisexual and mostly heterosexual girls and women were more likely to have purged in the past year to control their weight.
Right.
So they managed to omit the lesbians in the second par there. So the lesbians binge eat and then just keep it down. The bisexuals bring it
back
up.
Yes, we're going to take it on.
So we're quite happy to stuff our faces and have a Tim Tam Fest and go completely nuts. But we don't want to vomit it back up because that's a bit of a waste. Lesbians, maybe we're just a bit smarter.
I'm not wasting my Tim Tams for anybody.
Yeah, but I mean, it was quite shocking that there were 14,000 young people between the ages of 12 and 23, and to find that gays and lesbians actually came out on top in terms of who was suffering from eating disorders the most.
I think it goes back to the younger generation suffer more than us. We get older, we get a bit more concrete, don't we? We don't worry so much about stuff. And there is a lot more self-esteem, a lot more image development. You got your puberty, who am I, where do I fit in? And then you think you're different,
Well, an eating disorder would probably, you know, if you have something like that, then that's probably compensating, or that is a big red flashing light that you have other issues in your life, and maybe if you're dealing with your sexuality, maybe food's a comfort. Mm. I don't know. It's a long bow there, but...
No, I like that. That's a very nice bow.
You should go back to Harvard.
I love it. You're listening to Hear Me Roar on Joy 94.9. We're meeting Georgie. Georgie's come into the studio, and she's going to be discussing her journey in making a family with her partner, Rachel. Rachel and Georgie are much like any other lesbian couple, living their lives in their inner suburban home. They love to cook and share evenings, dining, laughing, catching up with friends. But for Rachel and Georgie, their home is incomplete. They want... You can do it again. Go on. That's it. Not a cat.
That did sound like a cat. I'm sorry. I apologise. Yeah, babies out there.
We'll try again later. They've embarked on a journey that many lesbians have travelled through and many others are yet to begin. Welcome, Georgie.
Thank you.
It's lovely to have you here.
Mm.
We've been chatting about this in the studio. I've been here a lot of the day today. And I've been asking, just going up to boys, go, hello, would you donate your sperm? And it's amazing the mixed response. So it'll be really interesting discussing that later. So
what sort of response did you get from people when you asked them that? Because it's not your everyday average small talk, is it?
No, but it is here probably. But I generally was, oh no. And then it was like, well, yeah, maybe, but there'd have to be conditions. And all of a sudden, it became very complicated. Mm. Oh, yeah, but I would only do it if this, or if it was a good friend, or if I could have parenting rights. But if I didn't have, I didn't want parenting rights, but I'd like to be able to visit, I'd like to know where my child was, and all that sort of stuff. So it was very different for every single boy I edged that question with. Now, Georgie, how long have you been a couple?
Rachel and I met just at the beginning of this year, so we haven't been together that long. And our journey, I guess, is made more urgent by my age and my desire really to have a baby soon because, you know, I've got a small window of opportunity.
So discussing parenthood came up quite quickly.
Yeah, pretty quickly.
In your relationship.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was it almost like a meeting point in terms of, you know, the two of you getting together?
I think Rachel knew pretty early on that family was something that was really important to me. And before we sort of discussed whether we were going to get serious, you know, or as part of that discussion about getting serious, you know, I had to sort of declare that I'm a package deal, if you like, and that I wasn't prepared to get serious with anybody who wasn't thinking about having a baby. So that was a discussion we had to have early on. Yeah.
And you said it's more urgent because of your age. How old are you?
38.
So is that a
but my eggs are 38 and a half, my doctor tells me, because you obviously your eggs start developing when you are in utero yourself. So your eggs are older than you.
Bad doctor.
So oh, that's awesome. Goodness.
It's like, ow.
It's like cat ears getting messed with. No. But if you, so is it more a matter of urgency because of, you know, relative childbearing years or fertility levels, or is it a legal thing for accessing IVF?
No, it's, in fact, your chances of accessing IVF increase as you get older, because they won't, you know, if you're over 40, they'll let you sort of circumvent the other methods of trying if you're a lesbian, and they'll let you go straight into the IVF program. But it's really just about wanting to optimise my age. Women's fertility decreases significantly after the age of 35, and it's just a really beautiful graph that Dr. McBain showed me that just was on this downward trajectory, and it's quite depressing when you sort of, you know, look at those sorts of things. So it's important to start as soon as you can without putting too much pressure on your fledgling relationship.
It does compound issues, and it's good that you've had that discussion early. How challenging were those early discussions? Did you want to carry? Do you want to carry?
Yeah, I want to carry the baby. Yeah, so
was that non-negotiable? That was part of the package.
Oh, if Rachel had been keen, that would have been something we could discuss. But she's older than me, so you know, it was never really a big. Well, there was no fight. We didn't have to arm wrestle for the right.
No mud wrestling then.
No.
Right. And what sort of avenues have you been looking down in terms of?
Yeah.
Becoming pregnant.
Yeah. We've been, so before I met Rachel, I've been talking to friends, straight friends and gay friends about the possibility, and I'd had a few people say, yeah, you know, I'd be interested and that sort of thing. But it's interesting that when you actually come to talking about, okay, this is the deal.
Serious now.
Yeah, serious. A friend sort of got a bit of cold feet and was like, oh, I'm not sure. And you know, logistics of another one being overseas. There's a few issues. It's quite interesting when you get down to the detail. You really start to understand people's commitment to it.
It is a quite difficult decision. Was looking at friends initially that your first option, or people that you know to be involved in raising a child with you as a co-parent in some form?
Yeah, I was never looking for a co-parenting arrangement with the male donor. I was always, my ideal was either to, my first choice would be to have a baby with my partner, my female partner. But if I was at the point where I was too old and single, I was going to definitely do it on my own. I wasn't going to sort of go, oh, well, the right partner never came along and I'm just, you know, destined to be mother or childless, you know, for the rest of my life. I would definitely look at, and I've got friends who have done it, who have, you know, just made the choice to be single parents. And, you know, I'm under no illusions how hard and difficult that would be. But I'm, you know, incredibly lucky that Rachel, who was totally wonderful, came into my life at the time she did and had already thought about having children in her life and wanting to be a parent. So it wasn't like it was a totally new concept to her. And, you know, the timing's not great because you start a relationship and then you have to talk about all these big full-on things rather than just be in love and, you know, happy and
go to movies.
I think you're right. It does make it really difficult and challenging because there you are, you're in love and it's like, we really need to have these discussions now. Mm. What kind of option, you said you considered IVF and so forth, would you consider different donor relationship? You were saying that you didn't want the partners also co-parenting.
Yeah, my preference is for a known donor rather than an anonymous donor.
Can I ask why?
Well, mainly, there's a couple of reasons. Rachel and I both think that there comes time in children's lives where they're interested in knowing their biological roots, and it's important, we think it's important for our child or children, if we manage to get one in, that they have an opportunity to investigate that. The second reason is through Melbourne IVF, who I'm associated with, the fertility clinic that I'm seeing, they have so few donors that they can only offer you 3 or 4 on their books at any given time, and there are so many lesbians and single women who are going to that clinic, the pool isn't very big, and while, you know, that's not a huge concern, we'd like to sort of widen the pool of lesbians having children, you know, rather than going to the same source.
So when you say known donor, you would select a friend of yours. Is that right? Is that what you mean?
Well, not necessarily a friend, but somebody who is maybe not known to us previously, but known to us through the process of looking for a donor, and we'd form a relationship with that person that is that will be ongoing, obviously.
So is this someone that you has already donated sperm, or someone that you would, say, advertise for? Because that's quite common as well, advertising in gay papers, online, that kind of thing.
Which is, in fact, what we've done. We haven't put a paid ad in the paper, but we were profiled in Melbourne Community Voice, MCV, and through that we hoped that we would find somebody who would be prepared to enter into this.
How did that come about? How did you come about going to MCV?
Well, Rachel and I were in New York, as you do, you know.
Yeah. Don't talk about
it. We were strolling down the street, and Rachel said, "Why don't we just advertise in the gay papers?" And I went, "Okay, good idea."
As you do.
It was New York that brought that out of
Well, that just happened to be where we were. I'm just showing off now.
We all hate you.
And so when we got back, I just sent an email to the editor of MCV and said, how do I go about advertising for a donor in your paper? And he emailed back and said, what about an article instead of an ad? And we thought, well, that's great. That's much more exposure.
It's a really good article.
Yeah,
it's a really lovely article. And it goes through, I think it was about 3 weeks ago now? I can't remember.
Yeah, 3 or 4.
So if you want to check it out, go into MCV, have a look on their website, and you can just, I think it was called Sperm Required for Loving Home.
Yeah, isn't that sweet?
Did you get any response from it?
Yeah, we did. We got about 4 or 5 responses. Interestingly, a couple of responses from outside Melbourne,
okay.
Which is interesting because, you know, that, I mean, obviously we need, the proximity is an important issue, so... Mm. But you know, just great, generous men emailing going, good luck, you know, what a great thing, we'd love to help, or I'd love to help.
Do you think you'd want your donor to be gay or straight, or would it not really matter to you?
It doesn't really matter to us, but Rachel makes the point in the article that she sees it as a political act for gay men to give lesbians their sperm, and vice versa for lesbians who don't necessarily want to create a family to give their eggs to men so that they can, you know, help, or, you know, or even look at a surrogacy arrangement so gay men can have babies too. She sees that as a political act for both of us to do that, you know, both gay men and lesbians. And I agree with her. It's not only is it helping lesbians have babies, but it's also about creating a next generation of gay positive kids who aren't necessarily going to be gay themselves, but they're going to be positive about gays and lesbians.
Georgie is looking to start a family with her partner, Rachel. Rachel, we are hoping you're feeling a bit better. She couldn't make it in the studio. We'd also like to touch on the subject of whether you listening would donate your sperm, whether you listening would donate your egg. And we're not saying to Georgie and Rachel, because that's not what this is about. But we'd really like to know, have you considered it? Would you consider it? And what kind of issues would you have thought about in that process?
I'd be really interested to hear what listeners have to say about the whole idea of creating a rainbow family, as it's kind of tagged these days too. Whether it's, we touched on it earlier, whether it's more common, whether people, that's something they want to do, or whether it isn't, and why not. I think that'd be also a interesting point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Now, I was going to ask, we touched on before, you said that through the fertility clinic there was only 4 or 5 available donors.
That's the only, that they would only show us 3 or 4 options. They might have 10 or 20, but of course they're on sort of rotation. So client, they would only show me 3 or 4 options that we would choose from. And that's just a basic profile of sort of eye colour, hair colour, height, motivation for donating, and, you know.
How many times can sperm from one donor be used?
I believe it's up to, they all have, assist up to 5 families with the same donor.
And so does the donor ever know how often their sperm has been used?
I'm not sure.
So theoretically, how many of their biological...
Sure.
From what I've heard, it's 10.
Up to 10 families.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, and it's really interesting. The profiles are really, really interesting, and it's quite daunting to read through them.
Mm. And I'm sure it has changed, but a few years ago, I did a few stories on rainbow families and IVF access in particular, and it was at a time when it was very difficult in Victoria, and a lot of single women and lesbians would go to Albury, and there was a clinic in Albury, which is just over the border in New South Wales, which had far more lenient laws on these things. But the problem was that there was only, because the donors have to give permission for their sperm to be used by lesbian couples, and there was a very scant amount of men who were doing so, and there was some talk about there's a lot of children in Melbourne daycare centres who looked very much alike. So surely that's got to be, that's got to be something to consider as well.
Well, the good thing about Melbourne IVF is that they don't allow their donors, their male donors, to stipulate whether their sperm can be used for straight or gay couple or lesbian couples. So it's, if you donate to Melbourne IVF, you're giving your sperm willingly to any woman who wants to get pregnant, which I think is really good, because that sort of discrimination isn't needed.
It is.
Yeah. No, that's great.
There's enough barriers.
Yeah.
So at this point, you're still looking at both avenues, finding a donor through advertising and... potentially through friends of friends or that sort of thing, like personal hookups, and also the IVF route.
Yeah, the clinic is always a fallback position for us, and that's something that we will definitely consider, if push comes to shove.
Georgie, what barriers have you faced in this? What have your family, friends and work colleagues, have you told anybody?
Yeah, everybody's been incredibly supportive, actually. My colleagues are constantly asking for updates at work and have you met anybody, and because I've seen the ad and all of that in the paper. But and my parents, again, have been, but they are in New Zealand, but they've been very supportive, ringing up and seeing how we're going. And I posted the ad on my Facebook page, and so my friends are sort of following the story. Yeah, so I'm very lucky. I've got a supportive workplace and supportive family.
Mm-hmm. You are lucky. I guess a lot of people out there don't have that support, do they, Tess?
Yeah, I'm just struck by how, a lesbian wanting to start a family, how premeditated all of it is. Mm. Like every ounce of your process has to be planned because everything has so many, variables.
Mm.
How have you found that? How have you found, going through the process? You're not just going to sleep with somebody and fall pregnant. Yeah. That's not going to happen.
I tend to look at that as a really positive thing because, and I never used to. And I can remember years ago when I first started working in Melbourne, I confided in a colleague of my desire to get pregnant and, how hard it was for lesbians. And she was a straight woman who had 3 small children. And she said, Georgie, look at the positives. I've fallen pregnant each time unplanned and agonised over whether I can afford to have this baby, whether I'm in the right relationship, whether all of these things, every single time being straight I just accidentally get pregnant. You have done all of the hard thinking and all of the planning. When you conceive, it's a solely joyful experience. And I'm not pretending for a minute that all straight people have that experience of agonizing when they find out that they're pregnant, but it really made me put a positive spin on this is the hard yards, but when we do get pregnant, Rachel and I are going to be, that's the most wanted and loved child.
I was going to say, that's a very good argument for saying that gay people will make great parents because of all the hurdles you have to go through and all the planning you have to do in the negotiation if you have a known parent and co-parenting and working out all the legalities and et cetera, et cetera. The time that baby arrives, you're set. You're like, bring it on, because this is like 3 years in the plan. It's like you're building a bridge
and
or
the
something.
Rest.
And boy, will that child be loved. Yeah. Like it is the, the product of so much effort and love for your partner and desire for a child. Like there is just so much.
Absolutely.
Desire for that baby.
Yeah. So wanted.
Yeah, rather than a 15-year-old girl who accidentally gets knocked up by, her high school boyfriend. Per se.
Sure.
They love them as well, but not as much planning goes
into. Yeah, but it's the planning kind of emphasis on that one, isn't it?
True.
Lovely, Grant. Hello, Grant. I definitely would like to be a father sometime in the future, but generally have no issue with the idea of donating sperm. Well, that's interesting. Good. I'm curious about what happens when the child does seek out their genetic father. As they are genetically related, does it cause any issues with inheritance, etc., What kind of legal stuff are we looking at here?
Well, thankfully the Brumby government has made changes to the law around women, lesbian women and single women getting accessing artificial reproductive technologies and other parts of the law around birth certificates. So, and I believe that that law is going to come into effect early next year, before I'm due to give birth or even pregnant, which means that Rachel and I will both be able to put our names on the birth certificate and not have at the moment, women who are getting pregnant in a lesbian relationship have to either choose to put unknown for the where the space for the father is, or name the donor. Now, if you name the donor, then there are potentially legal implications around supporting that child if anything should happen to the biological parent and those sorts of things, as I understand it. I'm no expert in all of this stuff. But when the law changes, it means that the two women who are legally or want, you know, intend to be legally responsible for that child can put their names on the birth certificate, which would absolve the responsibility.
Because that was one of the points that was brought up by the boys today in the studio, was what about the paternity issues?
Mm.
What about child support? What about this? What about that? And they said it's not that they wouldn't do it or consider it, but it's that grey area of the law that they felt threatened by and didn't really feel that they could sort of go into it.
Yeah. So if we go with a known donor, we would imagine we would have an agreement drawn up between us and him that would be very clear about Rachel and I taking on all parental responsibilities and financial and legal responsibilities for that child.
Would you need that even though it's both of your names on the birth certificate?
We think it would be good just in case there's anything down the track. And we understand that in family law, some of those agreements that have been written up as contracts between lesbians and male donors haven't necessarily withstood the test of the law, but they are used as a guide of the intention of the parties at that time. So, whether or not they are the sole factor the judge uses to determine if things go awry, they do assist.
Mm. Now, you just said that you've heard some stories. You, in your research to do this, you must have spoken with a lot of people, a lot of other lesbians who have created families in this way,
in all sorts of ways. Yeah.
What are some of the well, for want of a better word, horror stories or things that have just gone awry that you and your partner have learnt from and are sort of taking on board now in your journey?
I think there's common ones about lesbians being really so keen to get pregnant that the first offer of sperm they sort of take and go, don't worry about the details, or, we'll work it out as we go along, and it turns out that the donor is more keen than just to be a donor, so he might have expectations around parenting that the lesbian parents didn't anticipate. That's a common one that I've heard a number of times. So that's obviously particularly difficult with known donors, because it's really important to get those expectations up and out straight away.
Yeah, and that would include things like visitation particularly, or how much say they have in the child's life, what they can do, how late they can stay up, whether they can watch that TV show or not.
Well, that assumes a parenting role at all. So a guy that I was talking with and negotiating with a year or so ago, who was quite keen, then started saying things like, well, so what if you sent the kid to a school that I didn't approve of? And I was like, whoa, okay, hold on, this is where we draw the line between parenting and having an involvement in a child's life. And I tried to sort of liken it to an uncle role, like my brother might have an opinion about what school I send my kid to, but he can keep it to himself. So it's not his role, nor is it mine to tell my brother what to do with his kids in terms of their schooling. So it's that kind of delineation that I think is really important too.
And with a known donor, if you don't have that sort of rapport, then obviously that's kind of not the right path. If you don't mind me asking, how many men have you gone through?
How many men have you... Let's bring you chewed up.
We might rephrase that for you.
Yeah, no, I didn't want to. I thought about it and I let it rip.
Seriously, there was a friend that I have been speaking to about it for a while. I just think it's not the right time for him, and he's not in Australia, so that's become a lot more difficult. There was another friend in New Zealand. Turns out he had a vasectomy that he sort of forgot about.
As you do.
He's a straight guy with some, his own kids, so, you know, it was, okay. He would have been great, but, you know, his partner, who's a really good friend of mine, was going, they're reversible.
Oh.
Like, that's just too much effort.
But you just have to go into it with that really strong mindset of, you know, not ever getting your heart set on something.
Yeah.
Wait until you find the right one.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
I certainly hope you do. We've got a text in from Brendan in St Kilda East who said he wouldn't do it because he thinks that all couples should be able to have a child if they can, which is interesting.
Well, that,
what does he mean?
It sounds like he means that maybe they should be biologically
able.
Maybe that's because it's actually spelled on your text line, W-D-N-U-L-D, which maybe that means would.
I would do it. Let's go with that.
Right.
I think it doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it just makes sense. Friend in a homophobe, and I don't think he's the kind of man who'd be listening to Joy. I think he definitely would.
Brendan's going to go, you stupid girl, Sue. Well, let's just start again. I would do it because I think that all couples should be able to have a child if they can.
Mm.
Brendan, that's fantastic.
Thank you very much, Brendan.
I bet you that's Brendan texting me back in now. I think, let's have a look. I think it's selfish on the child that some lesbian couples refuse to allow access to the child to the donor dad, regardless of who brings up the child. He or she should know who their donor parent is, from Ant. What do you think about that?
I think there's a variety. Children are conceived by a variety of methods, some by choice and some just by necessity. So, for example, women who were forced by law in Victoria to go to Albury to conceive when the laws were such that it was very difficult for you to conceive in Victoria. The babies that are conceived in New South Wales, the law is there that children cannot trace the donor. That's just the way it is. So that's not a choice that those women are making about their children being able to trace donors. It's what the New South Wales government has made. So that's unfortunate, but it's sort of weighing things up. What is it better not to be born than to not be able to have the right to access your donor at age 18 when you want to know about or think about your biological roots. I mean, it should be said that not all children experience a strong urge to track their biological parents. I've got many friends who have been adopted, and some of them have really had a strong urge. Some of them have sort of gone, okay, I'll have a hunt and find them and go, that was great, but there's no connection or whatever. And others have had a really amazing experience and connection with their biological parents. So, you know, the experience varies. And, you know, while it might be seen as ideal, I don't think it's necessarily always ideal.
Now, rainbow families are becoming much more common. There's a big rainbow belt in the north of Melbourne. I think around Coburg and Preston, they're all sort of, you know,
Thornbury,
building cubby houses in the backyard of the picket fences up there. But you have obviously thought about beyond the conception and the birth to the raising the child and bringing it up in a lesbian household. What are your thoughts on where you think society is at with accepting children of gay parents?
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll always be challenges around that. I think just the way our society is structured, we live in such a heterosexist environment. It's really tough. Kids that go to school and it's Father's Day and they're all making cards for Father's Day, and lesbian parenting aside, there's no acknowledgement that a lot of kids grow up in single parent households and dad isn't around, regardless of the sexuality of the mother. So those sorts of things are always going to be tough. Rachel and I have talked about the fact that we just want to be upfront and, you know, honest and direct about our sexuality and be proud of that and be proud of the family that we create and role model that to our kids always, and you know, that's all you can do, I think, and create an environment where our child or children can talk about what goes on for them in the school environment and in their peer group.
Georgie, it sounds like you've got it all sorted. You just need that little bit of extra
magic
support.
Potion.
The little wiggler.
The little wigglers.
Wigglers. Swimmers. She needs the swimmers.
The swimmers. Thank you very much for coming in and
sharing
your journey. Could you keep us informed?
Yeah, keep
us posted on how it's going.
Yeah.
It'd be really interesting to follow. We have had one baby born, though, a hemi-raw baby.
We have.
We did. I can't remember his name. It wasn't Oscar. Oh, I have to remember his name now.
Otto? We'll find out very, very shortly.
We will. Someone takes in. Because of the home birthing legislation interview we did.
Oh,
gee, I can't remember his name. So thank you very much for having me.
It's been really
for coming in.
All the best of luck.
Thank you.
You're listening to Hear Me Roar on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.